How's that? Yeah, on-off switch in there. But it does come in. Did you find it in the handbook? I don't know how clear the answers are, but they are somewhere there, aren't they? Did you look in the handbook? Oh, I didn't think of that. All the answers are written down. Don't have to think. That's it. Yeah, so there's actually more than one debate, and but that's, I think if you understand this one, the other ones are kind of, well, no, well, we'll see. But just looking at my paper then, so that is a, you know, classic objection against the middle-way view. During the waking state, the 10 unwholesome actions, such as killing, do not exist, just as they do not exist in the dream state, because all dharmas are essenceless like dreams. And you could say all the virtuous actions as well, you know, in Tsongkhapa it says the virtuous actions, you know, virtuous karma doesn't exist, such as giving, because they do not exist in dreams. They do not exist in the dream state because all dharmas are essenceless like dreams. So as it's put there, how do you answer? If you're not used to debate language, you maybe don't know how to answer, but what would you say, Jason? Jason says no pervasion. Does that make any sense to anybody? Should it make sense to Stuart? What do you mean, two circles? Well, what no pervasion means is they accept that it's true that all dharmas are essences like dreams. So I think the Madhyamakas would accept that, wouldn't they? If you're in middle way, we'd have to accept that. If things don't have an essence, means that they don't have a way of existing from their own side. All dharmas, even those little building blocks, the ultimate particles or partless moments that the Abhidharmakas claim, or even the very mind, the Buddha nature of your own self, even that's not ultimately existent. So all dharmas are essenceless. And as an example of that, they give dreams or mirages. So that's a common middle way example. So what does it mean to you when you say, oh, all phenomena are like a dream? How do you explain that to somebody who's not familiar with Madhyamaka view? Why do you say all phenomena are like dreams then?
Like a dream in the waking state, so they are not
Well, that's kind of agreeing with the objection of the realist, though, isn't it? If you say, oh, things in dreams aren't real, therefore when you kill in a dream, you don't break your vow of killing, because it's not a real killing. So then in waking life, you're saying, equating it, that just as the dream isn't real, the waking life isn't real. Just as the dream isn't concrete, the waking life isn't concrete. So then the realists say, okay then, so if the monk kills somebody in waking life, then there's also, it's not a negative action. He doesn't lose his vows, he doesn't go to hell. Yeah, so that's what we're asking to you to make clear. See, you insist that life is like a dream. You know, Geshe Lhundrup Tsopa, his autobiography is called "Like a Waking Dream," isn't it? You know, so you're all supposed to think, "Oh, how wonderful!" You know, but in debate, you have to be able to say, "Yes, life is like a dream," but still. In a dream, if you dream that you kill somebody, you know, you don't create a negative action which will lead to hell realm rebirth, or don't break your vows. But if you kill in waking life, still, nevertheless, you know, you will suffer evil ripening effect, have to give up your life as a monk. So you've got to make...
Yeah. And what is similar to the dream, that it is not as concrete as we think, but what is dissimilar is that we do bear karmic results in the waking state.
Yeah.
Life is not being the same.
So then you're saying, if you say that they're both the same, like I was sort of getting from over there, you know. Oh, just as the dream is not real, so waking life is not real. So then the realist comes, oh yeah, so then there's no karmic consequence of killing in waking life, because there's no karmic consequence particularly of killing in a dream. So then we have the other view, oh no, actually, you know, although there are similarities which aren't explained, actually they are different, you know. So you kill in a dream, not with any particular karmic consequence. If you kill in waking life, heavy karmic consequence. So there's no basis for saying life is like a dream then.
Depends what you mean.
Waking life, I mean. Yeah. Yeah. Now that I agree with, that last bit. Yeah, when we say something's like a dream, it doesn't have to be like a dream in every respect. It doesn't have to be 100% like a dream. That would make it mean it is a dream. Yeah, but, you know, then you don't get it across to the realist, you see. Because the realist is saying, yeah, well, how are they different? And you're saying, oh, well, they're different because, you know, in one there is a heavy karmic consequence of killing. In the other one, there is very little karmic consequence of killing. And that's what he's arguing about. So if you're saying that's the difference, but, you know, it doesn't sort of get across why it's why we say things are like dreams, does it? Yes.
There is something outside, external, independent from us. But we say, no, it is not independent from us. It is like a dream. It depends also on our mind. It depends on our mind. That's what the life is.
Okay. So then the realist says, maybe, you know. Okay, so the person that you kill in the dream then isn't a real person. They're just a sort of construct of your mind. It's sort of imagined by your mind. Imagined to be out there. Nothing, no person from his own side, you know? So you're only killing like some sort of constructed thing that you've made up in your, you know, just appearance to your mind. But then in waking life, you, Madhyamikas, you say there is nothing from the side of the person in waking life. So even the person in the waking life, you agree, is just a construct of your own mind, is just sort of mere imposition, you know, imputation by your mind. And that when we look behind the imputation for something, you know, that's from the side of the object, we don't find it. So if killing the imaginative construct in a dream doesn't bring heavy negative consequences, then killing the imaginative construct in waking life, that also should not bring any heavy negative consequences. But we know that it does. We agree that it does. So we have to come clean. What about you, Stuart? Thank you, but we'll give somebody else a chance. Yes, exactly. So the realists have got you completely over the barrel, and they're boomeranging back on you now. So you can kill in a dream, but there are no dead bodies in dreams. You can kill somebody in a dream, but they don't die. No, I'm joking. So that's what we're trying to explain. We've got to explain that, and you're giving that as a reason. You know, that's what the realist wants to have explained. And you're just saying, oh, it's like that, you know. So we say, what? There's dreams, reflections, or mirages. You know, when you rise from meditation and emptiness, and you come back to, you know, the appearance of conventional truths, you have to say to yourself, oh, yes, things I must remember now to be mindful that things are just like dreams, like mirages, like the reflection of a moon in still water. So why do we say that? You know, as a reminder to us that not to grasp at the inherent existence of things. Well, I think it's like you say, just as the moon in the still lake, you know, you can imagine the child pointing to it and saying to his dad, look, oh, look, there's another moon. There's another moon in the lake. Yeah, so he's taking the reflection of a moon to be a moon, just like a naive person taking a reflection in a mirror, a reflection of a person in a mirror to be a person. So I think in the on the analogy side, you have to say, just in a dream, or let's say the moon, first of all. So, like the reflection of a moon appears to be a moon, but it is not. Okay? So, I appear to be inherently existent, but I am not. I think that's how the analogy is supposed to work, isn't it? You know, you in the desert or on a hot day on the black road, there appears to be a pool of water, but I know there is not. Just the same, I appear to be inherently existent, but I know that I am not. And this one is the this one is a dream, yeah? So, okay, when I dream of my mother, it seems, you know, my mother appears to be before me or appears to be with me, but she is not, you know, I'm just alone in bed. So I dream of my mother. My mother appears to be here, but she is not. Just like that, I appear to be inherently existent, but I must remember that I am not. So that's the way they're the same, isn't it? Something is appearing, but they appear, the way they appear and the way they exist is not harmonious. Yeah? It appears to be water, but it's just a mirage. It appears to be the moon, but it's just a reflection of a moon. Image of a moon. Yeah? So there appears to be my enemy in the dream, but there's nobody there. I'm alone in bed. Nobody's with me. Just like that, I appear to be inherently existent, but I am not. Things appear to, all, you know, phenomena appear to have their own a reality from their own side, but they do not. So that's how the Majjhimaka is trying to use those comparisons, isn't it? So on the one hand, you know, but you have to make clear of the difference, yeah, the similarity and the difference. Similarity is you have appearance that doesn't concord with reality. But on the dream side, something appears to be there that isn't there. My mother appears to be with me, but she is not. But on the meaning side of the thing you're actually talking about, yeah, I appear to be inherently existent, but I am not. So that's the first thing.
Just a quick question on we kind of take that as a given that we all appear to ourselves to be inherently existent. But how do you prove to someone that they appear to themselves as inherently existent? I mean, it's kind of always given that that's the way we conceive of ourselves. But how would you prove it to someone who doesn't think that they conceive of themselves as inherently existent?
Well, I think they have to introspect, don't they? Yes, when we walk around, before we've even heard of Buddhism, everything's appearing to be inherently existence and we're grasping at it. But the first time we hear it, those are just completely foreign words, and no idea what they mean, you know, completely unfamiliar. So we're doing it, but we don't realize it. So then, yeah, you have to discuss with somebody how it's happening, what's happening. So I don't think it's a question of proving to them, like you use a perfect correct sign. It's like, how does it feel? Yeah, but is that going to work?
No, that won't work. So, you know, still that's the correct sign.
Well, I think what you're saying to them is, what you might say to them is, okay, you get angry, now look at that moment, just when you were about to get angry, how did you feel about yourself? Well, look at the person you're angry with, if it's a person, you know, how do you feel, what's happening there? And then you have to try and get them to see that what they're grasping at is something shorn of its dependent relationships. You know? My obvious example, we haven't got time to, I haven't got time to think of a new example, like, you know, if you're waiting somebody and they're late, and this is, you know, I'm sure it's happened to you, it's happened to me, and then you get angry. Why the heck are they keeping me waiting, you know? They promised to be here at 2:30, and now it's already 2:50, you know, and I've got to go back to work, and so you can get uptight. So you're thinking, oh, that person's just useless, you know, all they ever think about is just their children, or, you know, all they ever think about is doing their shopping, and that's why they're late. They're just spending too long in the supermarket and not coming on time, you know, because they're busy picking up their bargains. You know, you sort of get really, you sort of start putting that person down, don't you, mentally. Isn't that true? When you get angry with somebody, you have to sort of despise them. And that is definitely true if you think about it. But then when the person comes to you and you say, oh, you know, I'm sorry I'm late, but, you know, I was just getting my child off to school after lunch and he was sick on the floor or something. You know, so when you hear of the situation, why the person was late, and it's a very good reason, you know, and this is in the days before mobile phones arise, you know, then your anger dissipates, isn't it? Or when I get angry with my dad, you know, because he's just doing something really irritating when I'm looking after him. But as soon as you remember, he's a 90-year-old person who's got dementia and, you know, he's going downhill. You know, you can't get angry with him if you really realize, if you really remember why he's so helpless. So that's, you're getting angry because you are seeing him and yourself and that divested of the dependent relationships. If you don't think why he's so stupid, you know, or why he's so slow, why he's so incapable, and just putting down, oh, just a stupid old man, you know, why am I stuck with this stupid old man? You know, then you'll shout at him. But if you remember that he's the person who looked after you for 20 years, you know, when you were very helpless, and you remember that he's, you know, he's afflicted by an awful disease, and he's carried that burden of, you know, years so long that, and all that, you know, then you can't get angry with somebody once you remember all that. So that's how you say now, you see somebody shorn of their dependent relationships, the reasons why they're like that, and that's how you get angry with them. And so aren't you seeing the person, grasping them to be inherently existent, you know, inherently stupid, or and grasping yourself to be, you know, important because you are existing for your own side, you know, not as if your life depended on him for 20 years and all his generosity and everything. So that's how you talk to somebody.
But your example of someone being late, what happens if they really were late because they were being selfish? And you do the same problem about being selfish. So it could still work in that case.
Well, if somebody really is, what kind of person are you calling them? An idiot, or an enemy, or...
Well, you said the reason you relaxed is because you realised they had a legitimate reason.
Mm.
That's slightly different to them if they're just late because of a non-legitimate.
Yeah. Well, they're a dosser, right? They're somebody who just doesn't turn up on time, yeah? Because they're just spaced out or something. So what's the point of getting angry with a dosser, yeah? Getting angry and shouting, then that's not going to change their behaviour. They're just stuck in that groove, man. So what's the point of getting angry with the dosser? If there's something you can do about it, then you do it. But with the dosser, there's nothing you can do. So you kind of got to expect them to be late. So if you expect them to come on time, then you've in unskillful thinking on your part. And it's your karma that they should be late. Anyway, karma answers everything. Yeah, so that's one answer. So where do we go from there? Yeah, that we agree that things are like dreams, and we agree that they're essenceless, but there's no pervasion. That just because killing in a dream is without karmic consequences, it doesn't mean that killing in waking life is without consequences. How is it like a dream? It's like a dream because of the way it appears and the way it exists are two different things. Yeah, the analogy of a dream is to show you that the way they exist and the way they appear, two different things. Like the water appears, the water of a mirage appears as to be water, but it isn't water. Yeah, this water in my kitchen is like the water of a mirage because it appears in one way but exists in another. But the gap between appearance and reality in both cases, they're different gaps. So the gap in the mirage is that it appears to be water and it isn't water, it's just hot air on or something reflecting the blue of the sky or something, I don't know. But the water in your kitchen, that's appearing differently from the way it exists because it's appearing to be inherently existent when it isn't. So that's the idea. You've got to get the similarity and the difference. You know, you've got to be able to explain both of those if you're going to defend your case skillfully. Well, I don't think so. Why would there be a... So when you think about pot, the pot you think about is permanent? The conceptual representation is permanent, but the pot you're thinking about, that doesn't have to be permanent. Have to think about that one. Yeah, but I think we better keep to this. What do we say next? I don't know. Well, that's not the first answer, though. Shall we read the book? Yeah. I mean, there is karma in dreams, yeah. There's something about that. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
But that's in the next dispute. The first one we're still on, yeah. So let's read what it says in the book. If phenomena are like dreams, then virtuous and non-virtuous karma are not collected even during the day, because karma and its results do not exist ultimately. They are like empty, like dreams. So this is on page 159, top. Yeah. Reply, our system. We accept that karma is not ultimately created during the day. However, this does not mean that karma is not created during the day conventionally. Karma does exist conventionally. Therefore, it is correct to say that karma is created conventionally during the day. Is that satisfying? Is that satisfying, Alison? Is that satisfying, that answer? Well, everything exists conventionally, doesn't it? Yes, well, they're thinking that if it exists, it has to exist ultimately. If it exists, it has to be findable from its own side. So that's the only way things can really be taken seriously, you know, if that's their position. So if there's nothing from the object's own side whatsoever, even these ultimate building blocks, then to them there's no reality, you see. There's nothing real, so you're just juggling, you know, fictions like Alice in Wonderland type of whatever you think is there sort of thing. But we're saying that's not true. You know, the only way things can exist is by not being ultimately existent. If things were ultimately existent, cause and effect couldn't take place, you know. If fire ultimately exists, inherently exists by way of its own power, then it doesn't need any fuel to burn, because it's just, it burns by its own power. It's hot and burning by its own power, so it doesn't need any causes. And then if it exists by way of its own power, exists from within itself, then even if you throw a huge bucket of water on it, it won't put it out, because it just burns by its own power. It doesn't burn depending on having dry fuel. It doesn't burn depending on having oxygen. It just depends upon itself. So you could never stop it. So anything that's ultimately existent, as they claim things have got to be, then it wouldn't work. It couldn't perform a function. It couldn't be in the stream of cause and effect. So the only way things can exist is by not being ultimately existent. So the only way things can things like karma and killing take place is on a conventional level. They can't ultimately take place. So that's the way it is. This clinging for ultimate existence is just this is just wrong consciousness. So they want to say things exist ultimately as they appear, but there's no way they can. So you have to accept that that appearance is a false appearance. Things are like dreams. They exist in one way, but they appear in one way, but exist in another. But nevertheless, they perform the functions. So in waking life, you have an actual person. We won't say real person or an ultimately real person, but in waking life you have a person. In a dream you just have an imaginary, an imagined person. So if you go up to Jason and try and establish whether he's a person, you know, we talk to him, you know, shake his hand, you know, check out his backstory. He's born from a certain person, you know, he's got a passport, you know, he's got all the person. As you search there, you don't find the person existing from their own side, you know, amongst the parts. There's no sort of person kind of ultimately there. But, you know, you get the sort of reinforcement of the first initial cognition, oh, he's a person. Then you talk to him and you examine his, records, you go on the internet, searches, you know, and then you get lots of corroborating evidence, don't you? It's not that you get an ultimate proof, oh, he's ultimately a person of his own side, but you get lots of, further valid cognizers which reinforce the first one. Whereas you go look at the person in the dream and you say, okay, but then you can't find anything about the person. There's an image of a likeness of a person disappeared instantly, but then what? You know, in waking life, you look for that person. And, all you're going to see, well, I had this sort of appearance of a person to my mind, but now where is he? You know, if it was a person, there'd be some, you know, future, or, you know, he'd either be, you know, we'd find his body lying somewhere, or, you know, he'd have gone off and caught a train to Sheffield or something, or, you know, but nothing's happened. It's just an appearance to your mind which has disappeared. So the more you search into that one, the less it looks like it was a person after all. It was just an appearance to your mind. It wasn't a person, yeah? So that's, the child goes and throws a stone in the lake, and then the image of the moon disappears. So then you realize it's not a moon, you know. If you investigate that further, you find, oh, there's no moon there. And you walk up to the mirage, So that when you get closer and look at it very closely, then there's no water there. So the water disappears. It wasn't, well, there's never water any there, but the appearance of water goes away. So even though there's no water on the side of actual water, you know, you just get a lot of a lot of supporting evidence, a lot of, you know, further valid cognizers which affirm, you know, confirm that it's water. You never find water from its own side, but it's obviously doing everything water should. It gets hot, it gets cold, it quenches your thirst, you know, it tastes like water, and you put it under the microscope and you see these molecules, whatever. But the water of mirage, you know, you go there and it's just, there's nothing there. It's just like dirt road and warm air or something. So the water of the mirage and the water, they're both the same in not appearing from their own side. They're both the same in not being inherently existent. But there's very much a great difference between one of them being water and one not being water. Anybody convinced? Yes. So phenomena are like dreams. They appear in one way, but the you know, there appears to be, there appears to be a person there, but there isn't a person there. So if there isn't a person there, you can't kill anybody. In waking life, yes. The person appears to be inherently existent, but they're not inherently existent. But there's still a person there. And then, you know, that person you can kill. Yes, but you can see there's plenty to think about, you know. Any comment, Alison? Yeah. So it's such a common analogy. Oh, yes, we think of everything just being like dreams, but then to come down to it, you know, it's people really kind of, you know, skilled in arguing from the other point of view, then. You've got to sort of be able to answer them. It's can be challenging. But the other one to think about is the snake and the striped rope, isn't it? You know, person goes out at dusk and sees a striped rope, but they think it's a snake. It appears to their mind as a snake because it's going dark, and this is a country where they have lots of snakes, and some of them are very poisonous. So, you know, you're kind of a bit paranoid about seeing shapes in the grass. When you're walking. So you see a snake, it's actually a striped rope, but you see a snake. So then that's obviously just, you know, an imputation of mind. And that's a wrong imputation. But then the Madhyamikas, you know, the middle way people, we're saying, oh yeah, but the real snake, the actual snake that, the actual creature, that's also just, you know, merely imputed by your mind. There's nothing from the side of the snake that is a snake. When you look over amongst those parts, you'll never find a snake existing from its own side. You never find a snake that exists by way of its own nature. So that's also a mere imputation. So then the realist is going to say, so that's how ridiculous your view is. You know, you can't discriminate between the snake that's merely imputed, the snake that's imputed onto a striped rope, and the snake that's imputed onto the aggregates of a snake. For you, in both cases, there's nothing from the side of the snake. There's nothing from either side of them which is a snake. Yeah? So both of them are mere imputations by mind. Yeah? So that's a fault for the realist, you see. So that just exposes the weakness of your middle way view. You've no way of discriminating. So this one is a snake and this one isn't. We know that, you know, this one's a snake, that one isn't, but you've no way in your view of showing that. We say, yes, you go over to the snake, and then you find, you know, something that's really there, which justifies the imputation of a snake. We find these ultimate building blocks, whatever they are, you know, the aggregates of a snake, or the DNA of a snake, or, you know, the sort of atoms in a certain configuration, which justify the imputation snake. So there's something which, from its own side, has, you know, exists the snake, and you can't find that. So how do you discriminate between one's a snake and one isn't? Exactly. There doesn't have to be anything from the side of the snake for there to be a correct imputation of the snake. It only has to be like this certain body, this certain, you know, curved tail, or this certain, you know, lack of legs, or this certain forked tongue, you know. So when they're all in place, then the imputation of snake is perfectly correct. But there's no intrinsic, you know, snakeness from the side of any of those. Yeah, so there are correct imputations and wrong imputations, so that's what you have to get across to these people. Just because it's okay to impute this as a hat, it doesn't mean you can impute a hat anywhere, you know. It has to be more to it than that. Yeah, but we need a cup of tea now. Let's... Yes, but if we had time, you could say yes. But then they do talk about, even in dreams, there can be some karma. There can be karma from dreams, but it's much less strong karma in a dream than it is in waking life. The mind in a dream is confused. The mind in a dream is, you know, not operating at full strength. It's like it's sort of under the influence of sleep, and then... The karma it produces is much weaker. So even if when you awaken, you say, oh yes, I'm glad I did that in the dream, you know, and rejoice in it. So even if you have a reinforcement from the waking state, looking back on the dream, you know, after the action has just been completed, that sort of a rejoicing in the dream, it still won't amount to a fully qualified action of killing. And then when you get down to the monk's vows, then it's the Buddhist pronouncement that these vows are things you keep in the waking state, and what you do in dreams doesn't count. Just as if you are insane and you kill somebody, then you don't lose your vow of killing. Like if you're a monk, you know, you've taken a vow not to kill. And if you break their vow, you have to, you know, leave the sangha. You have to stop being a monk. But if you kill somebody when you're completely insane, then that's not considered a breakage of the vow. It's some negative karma, but it's not the fully qualified negative action that amounts to killing such that would break your vow. You see, because you know you don't know what you're doing. I've got some sort of mental kind of, you know, insanity or something. So if you don't know what you're doing, you can't do it deliberately, or you know, not deliberately in the way that it's set out to be a breakage of the vow. Or they say if somebody's delirious with pain, that's the other one. If you're delirious with pain and you kill somebody, that's just like, you know, if you kill somebody accidentally, You know, you're just, how could you kill somebody accidentally? Well, I don't know, I don't know, how could you do it? Well, a good example of killing somebody accidentally? Yeah, you're driving the car very cautiously, very safely, you know, within the speed limit and looking what you're doing. But a little kid runs out very suddenly in front of you, who's playing, and then they're under the wheels of your car before you've had time to put the brake on. It's possible, isn't it? So you're killing accidentally. So that would not be a breakage of the vow of killing. So the killing in a dream's like that. All the factors aren't complete. So even if it was a person, you know. So killing in a dream, killing when you're insane. So none of those are actually breakages of the vow. Okay, we better have a cup of tea. We're getting late now. The usual, yeah. Yeah, okay. Go when you want to. Go in. It's okay if we meditate, doesn't matter. Yeah, good to see you.
Thank you very much.
This is the last weekend, so.
Yes. It's good to see you.
Thank you. Yeah, well, I hope some of it stays with you. You get
yes,
a chance to study the ornament more carefully in future.
Thank you.
Yes.